The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Chief Judge Siegel, and Judge Halbrooks, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, counsel. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You are here for the second argument of four today. This case is A20-1352 in the matter of the welfare of the child of NRCA. We have 15 minutes for each of you for your principal arguments. When you start, as you know, please state your name and the party you represent for the record. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. And counsel for appellant, we're ready to go if you are.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court. My name is Chang Lau. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, NRCA. In 2017, appellant was charged with possessing pornographic works for receiving sexually explicit text messages from his then-girlfriend, DB. Appellant and DB were both teenage minors, and appellant did not solicit these texts from DB, who initiated the sexually explicit communications. DB was not charged with the crime. As a result, appellant was ordered to comply with probation and participate in sex offender treatment for over a year as part of a continuance for dismissal agreement with the state. Even so, he was ultimately adjudicated delinquent of possessing pornographic works and required to register as a predatory offender for 10 years. Now, in my brief, I raise four arguments as to why appellant's juvenile delinquency adjudications should be reversed. Today, I would like to focus this court's attention on the second argument, dealing with selective prosecution. That argument asks this court to reverse appellant's delinquency adjudication for sexting or exchanging sexually explicit text messages with DB because under the facts of this case, the state's decision to prosecute appellant and not DB constitutes impermissible discriminatory prosecution and violated appellant's right to equal protection under the law. Now, in the proceedings below, appellant moved to dismiss the pornographic work charges on the grounds of the state's decision to charge him and not DB was invidious and violated the Equal Protection Clause. The juvenile court ruled the fact that appellant was 2 years older than DB was sufficient by itself to justify the state's disparate treatment of the two minors. The lower court's ruling was error for three reasons. One, as the juvenile court ruled, appellant and DB are similarly situated individuals. Two, appellant presented a prima facie showing that the state's discriminatory treatment of him and DB was based on sex or was arbitrary, in other words, invidious. And three, the difference in appellant's and DB's ages did not by itself rebut that prima facie showing. Accordingly, the state violated appellant's constitutional rights and his delinquency adjudication for possession of pornographic works must be dismissed.
So can I, and you'll get into this no doubt, because obviously you're focusing on it, but I just want to frame it. Is your argument then, I mean, you would agree that the in such a claim, the defendant has the burden of proving by a preponderance of the evidence that there is selective prosecution.
That's right, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, I'll just, and then I want to hear from you for sure, but is the argument that you're making that it was clear error for the district court to find on this record that there was a gender neutral basis for the prosecution decision? I mean, I'm not sure whether you're arguing that age is just an invalid factor or that it is in fact the defendant proved that it was not a gender neutral decision.
Also, my argument here sort of tracks the three pronged analysis put forward by the United States Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court in cases such as Russell. So the first is that there must be a showing that there were similarly situated individuals. The second is that there must be a prima facie showing, and that requires proof by a preponderance of the evidence that the prosecution of one child, appellant, and not the other, was based on either sex or was arbitrary. Now, you know, the case law refers to that requirement, that burden, as a prima facie showing, which, you know, I think there's some conflict between prima facie showing and preponderance of the evidence. But if we look at what occurred here, which was that there were two individuals who were both minors under the pornographic work statute, and one minor who, the minor who initiated the sexually explicit communications was not charged and was a female. I think that establishes, by preponderance of the evidence, that there was some invidious intent here. Now, the third prong of that test requires the state to provide legitimate reasons as to why they charged one individual appellant and not the other, DB. And in this case, they posited two reasons. One was age, and that's what the district court relied on. And one was relative maturity, which the state argued below and continues to argue on appeal. Our argument here is that the preponderance of the evidence shows, at least before the state provides those reasons, that there was invidious discriminatory intent.
Okay, and but then now we're there. And right. Then the state gives two gender neutral reasons, age and maturity. Then who has the burden? I assume it's according to, as I look at the BAH case, BAH bears the burden of establishing by preponderance of the evidence that the decision to charge was invidious. So the burden ultimately, I mean, it's similar, I suppose, to like Batson, even under your analysis. Ultimately, the challenger has the burden, well, right?
I mean, pursuant to the framework provided by this state's case law, my understanding of the reading of that case law is that there's initial showing that must be made in that second prong. And then, you know, by definition, the rebuttal from the state requires that the burden be on the state, right, to rebut that prima facie showing. So there's, I mean, I think.
So your argument is that the state bears the ultimate burden of proving that the reason was gender neutral, not that your client has the burden of showing, not that the defendant has the burden of proving ultimately that there was invidious discrimination.
Right. So okay. The defendant just needs to have that, appellant just has that prima facie showing burden that needs to be proved by preponderance of the evidence. BAH is pretty clear that the state is the one that needs to provide that rebuttal, right? And in BAH, they did. And they looked at the facts of the case and they cited seven or eight reasons as to why they charged BAH and then not the minor, right? And they list them in a list form. One of them was that BAH was the one that initiated the sexual contact or the sexual conduct. And in addition to the fact that, you know, he brought some paraphernalia, alcohol to the meeting that led to the incident. Whereas the state doesn't do that in this case.
Can I ask another quick question though? So are mm-hmm. they really similarly situated? You're saying they are because they're both under the age of 18, but there are statutes that distinguish between, are you under 13? Are you under 16? Is there more than 2 years difference? I mean, so are they really, and what do we look to in figuring out, like, what's the best case law to figure out, are these two really similarly situated?
Well, I will say at the outset that both the district court and the state conceded that the two individuals are similarly situated, right? The state in their brief and the district court.
You're right. Thanks for reminding me of that. Yep. You're right.
And separate and apart from that, you know, we have to look at the significance of the age difference in serving either public policy or a legitimate purpose of the statute, right? So if the legislature intended to make criminal all possession of pornographic works involving children under the age of 18, regardless of if you possess pornographic works involving a kid who's 16, 14, that's a crime, right? And so in this situation, both individuals, according to the state's definition of the statute, committed crimes. Both juveniles possessed pornographic works involving minors under the age of 18. So in that way, they are similarly situated.
Okay. So can I turn your attention if that's okay with the presiding judge, to your other argument about interpreting what's a pornographic work, unless my panel members have more questions on the equal protection. Is that okay if I turn that? Okay.
Of course.
All right. Okay. So in looking at the definition, and I'm going to ask this of the prosecution as well. In looking at the definition of what's a pornographic work, it has to use a minor. So how do we interpret the word use in the context of this case? And what do we look to in trying to figure out what that means?
Right. And you know, neither of us really addressed that issue in our briefs. And, you know, I obviously have some thoughts on it. That was an issue that we considered in drafting briefs at the outset. You know, one of the difficulties interpreting that particular provision is that there's an insinuation that there's a person being used by someone else, right? It's not explicit. So I think there is some inherent ambiguity there. But there is the implication that the person who is the quote unquote victim or who is being being preyed upon is not the person who is also creating the content and using that content.
And you do argue it in looking at subdivision one of 617.247, correct? Because you point
correct
to the intent that the intent of the legislation is that minors not be used.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor.
Yeah. All right.
I mean, and right. And I think you're absolutely right that those two points tie together. In that when a teenager such as DB voluntarily uses images or videos of themselves, makes them, and then sends them to other individuals wholly voluntarily, other teenagers who are similarly situated, that based on a plain reading or based on statutory interpretation of pornographic work statute, that the legislature did not intend to prosecute those who received that type of content.
So is it, and there's no evidence in this record, and it's kind of a skeleton record because it was a very short
trial.
Yep. That this felony crime is premised on your client's failing to delete the images, correct, off his phone, and I believe it also showed up on his iPad.
That's right. And I think that's part of the absurdity, unreasonableness argument that we make in that statutory interpretation portion of our brief, is that this is a case where appellant did not ask for this content. He did not ask for these sexually explicit videos or pictures. DB testified to that at trial. And there's some other evidence in the record, you know, primarily from my client, where he indicates that, you know, I didn't ask for this. I knew this was kind of wrong, but DB sent it to me and, you know, and he received it. And he is effectively prosecuted for that, where he is not actively doing anything other than receiving that content that was sent to him completely unprompted, at least not by him. And I know that there was an exchange, but, you know, ultimately he was charged with the possession of this content and not the dissemination of it, right? So, you know, I think it's unreasonable to make it a crime in a situation like this, because, you know, there really isn't any degree of culpability here. In addition to the fact that these two are juveniles, are teenagers, and, you know, for all variety of reasons that argued in my brief, you know, they're less culpable because of their level of development, both brain development and sexual development.
Mr. Lau, you don't have much time left. I just want to return again, if we could, to, of course, the district court's conclusion that it was rational. It was a rational basis to conclude that the age difference here between the two individuals, you know, supports the prosecution of your client and not DB. Setting aside that other case, BH, I think, you know, where there are so many factors, I mean, it's very different factually. Here we've got basically one basis for this decision. How are we to evaluate that? I'm struggling with that a bit because, I mean, it seems it is a rational basis, age. You know, can you give us any guidance with respect to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think my first response is I respectfully disagree that it is a rational basis, right? I mean, for it to be a rational basis, the charging decision has to serve the legitimate policies of the statute. And like I was arguing before, charging appellant in this case and not charging DB in this case does not further the public policy behind the pornographic work statute. It does not deter this action. If sexting between voluntary teenagers is in fact a crime, prosecuting appellant and not DB because there's that 2-year age difference. Your Honor, may I finish my answer, please?
Please do. Please do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Prosecuting appellant and not DB is not a rational basis because it does not serve any legitimate public policy purpose and it does not further the purpose of the statute. And so for
just a follow-up question to that, if I may, Judge Smith,
please.
I mean, with that argument, and I understand what you're saying, but then all minors would have to be charged under these circumstances. That's the outcome of your argument, is it not?
Or none of them are charged.
Okay, right? But one and or so the other extreme.
You can call that an extreme, but in this case, it's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause because there's no legitimate purpose to treat these two individuals differently. And that's unfair. And so for the purposes of fairness, for the purposes of vindicating the equal protection rights of my client, either both of them to be charged or neither of them are.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'll just follow up, take that privilege here for a second. And I assume that you might have a different argument, maybe not, if someone's 17 or 13 or 17 or 12 or 17 and 11. Maybe not. It strikes me that, as I am understanding your argument, you recognize the state forwarded a gender-neutral reason. You think in this case, as applied to this case, it's irrational.
That's right.
Is that right? Okay.
That's right. And then, you know, the state's argument is that that age difference by itself demonstrates the maturity of one over the other. And our argument is that the record is completely devoid of that. It does not support that contention, right?
Okay.
So, you know, maybe you can say a 17-year-old and 12-year-old, there's enough of an age gap there to infer that the 17-year-old is far more mature than that 12-year-old. But, you know, there may be the same arguments to be made in that case where the 12-year-old is the one that starts these communications, right? I mean, it just...
Okay. I think we understand your argument, Mr. Lau, and you will have time for rebuttal as well.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, thank you. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Rachel Evenson. I am an assistant Itasca County attorney, and I represent respondent, the state of Minnesota. First, I just have a couple corrections to my written brief. The first was that I used probation violations, and technically what appellant violated were the terms of his continuance for dismissal, and he did so numerous times. And the material violation of the continuance for dismissal was that he did not comply with term B, which was complete a psychosexual evaluation and follow all those recommendations within the time frame, which was prior to his 19th birthday. He was given additional time to comply with those recommendations as well, but he failed to do so. That recommendation from the psychosexual, number one, was that he complete a residential sex offender treatment program. He did not do that. Part of the reason that the recommendation was for a residential was that after he was charged with this offense, he reoffended similarly. And apparently there was a Snapchat with another 14-year-old sending him pornographic images. I would just note, before getting into the age difference argument, that this idea that she initiated everything, this 14-year-old victim initiated everything, is not really supported in the record. And the evidence is different. The victim...
So wait. So can you point out to me where it's not supported in the record? Because from my reading of the record, there's the transcript from the continuance for dismissal hearing. Mm-hmm. And then there's the victim's testimony at trial. And neither of those, she testifies that she initiated it. And there, and the NRCA doesn't add anything. So where in the record do you point to the contrary? Aside from the fact that she's 14 and he's 16.
Sure. And I'll concede that yes, she sent him materials, but I think the record is unclear who started these conversations, what these conversations were like.
Specifically are you pointing to? Because her testimony is that she initiated, I think she uses the word initiate in her testimony. So if you can point me to us to the record and not summarize, and you don't have to, you know, you can take your time, and if you don't have it, that's okay. I don't want to put you, but I also don't want you to say things that aren't reflected in this record and what the prosecutor actually proved in this record, because that's the record we have to deal with, not sort of a general societal, you know, victimization mm-hmm. of younger kids scenario.
Indeed. And I would just point you to the transcript of her testimony at pages 9, 10, and just my concern in looking at the testimony was that initiate had taken on maybe a bit of a different context. Yes, she had sent these things, but that it was unclear that and even if she brought up these things, this idea that the appellant didn't want them, he saved them on multiple devices and still had them weeks later. This is a situation where these two were in a, they had just started a relationship.
But again, is that evidence in the record that he saved them to multiple devices? Or that they just automatically showed up because he has text message both on his iPad and his phone. I mean, we need to focus on the evidence mm-hmm. in this record, which is very bare bones, I will point out.
Your Honor, those messages were sent via Facebook, and so they were saved. And even in the complaint, I believe there's a notation in seeing those that they are from a Facebook.
So Facebook, if you have Facebook on your cell phone, and we're at way outside the record here because there's nothing in the record on this, and you've got it on your iPad, is there any evidence in the record that was presented that showed that he actively took some action to save it besides just not deleting it from his Facebook account?
I am not... I don't have the answer for that. And just as a practical and pragmatic.
And I'm sorry for sounding so harsh, but I mean, it is a very bare bones record here that we're faced with for a felony level offense.
You're correct. That was not addressed more in the underlying record. I would just go back to that age difference and how that age difference really
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you. So I wanted to do just this as sort is put you up away from looking at, you started talking about, well, there might have been this difference between what initiate means. Okay, but if we step back for a second, if we look at the district court's factual findings as to the claim of selective prosecution, and the court's order says that the state asserted the age difference is the non-discriminatory gender neutral reason. Court finds is to be rational. Child has not shown that he was intentionally or purposefully discriminated against for an impermissible reason, namely his gender. So I would assume, but I want you to tell me if I'm wrong, that what we should be focusing on is the district court's factual finding that the reason was not gender, it was age. And then the district court's determination that was rational. And so going into other things about the initiated, it seems to go beyond the factual finding. So it seems to me there might be a difference between the two of you who has a burden of proving, as a matter of fact, what the reason was. And so I want you to speak to that and speak to what I think is the district court's sole basis, which is age, as effectively the age difference, I think, between the two, and why that is a set, why that shows non, that it was not selective prosecution.
Thank you, Your Honor. The trial court made a correct determination in finding that appellant did not satisfy the burden that he had in showing a preponderance of the evidence that the decision to prosecute him and not the victim was invidious or for some discriminatory purpose. And the age as a rational reason, I think, is borne out in many areas of the law that speak to juveniles. The criminal sexual conduct statutes differentiate based on age, where the difference in 24 months is potentially a third degree criminal sexual conduct charge. Here, there's 28 months difference, nearly 28 months difference between the two. The juvenile justice treatment of juveniles is also sometimes based on age, where you might have a 16 or 17 year old who would have a presumption for adult certification, but the 14 year old would not have that same presumption. And it's valid to distinguish on age because of developmental vulnerability. Citing to the BAH case, while we might not have as many factors as exist in that case, I think it's a very fact-specific determination that happens case by case. And that's what the trial court did in this matter, was look at the specific facts of this case in making that determination.
So what is expected? I mean, it seems to me that the argument, there was not evidence at the pretrial hearing on this question. Or was there? It was argued that there is an age difference, and I guess the age difference is, of course, that was unchallenged. It's reflected in the complaint or wherever it is. But what about the relative maturity or what the prosecutor, you know, I think that's the argument as well. The age difference doesn't reflect with respect to these two, what the difference is between them, et cetera.
Sure. And I would just note that this wasn't a pretrial. The appellant had taken the advantage of the continuance for dismissal and provided testimony back in April of 2017, and it didn't challenge his guilt. And so this matter came up when it looked like the continuance for dismissal was going to be terminated. So at that point, the court has some more information about each of these parties through the psychosexual that had been completed, as well as experience working with appellant through the continuance for dismissal and the number of hearings where he was violating the terms of that continuance for dismissal.
So that raises a question. Thank you. That raises a question for me. The question is whether the charge, I think, but tell me if I'm wrong, whether the decision to charge and not charge was an example of selective prosecution. Can a district court take into account information it gains later that was not known at the time of charging to respond to a selective prosecution claim?
And that's a very good question. And potentially the district court should not be taking into consideration those later known factors. In this case, I don't know that it matters because age was a rational reason that the state presented, as well as the difference in maturity.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
And then I would just note that the trial court committed no clear error or abuse of discretion in this case. And the trial court was really in the best position to assess the claims that were raised by the appellant as the case proceeded, and correctly held that appellant had materially violated the terms of that continuance for dismissal agreement. The continuance for dismissal agreement was appropriate in this case because a stay of adjudication may have only given him a year to complete the services that were needed, where the continuance for dismissal allowed additional time to be able to get those services and supports to address some of the underlying deviant sexual behaviors that were noted. And while he was at treatment, it was noted he was a passive participant. He had limited understanding of his offending patterns. It was noted he was very intelligent. And then there was misconduct while he was in the program, with him reoffending with another program participant. He was also offered that additional time to satisfy the terms of this continuance for dismissal. And that's where I would just note that the juvenile justice system is maybe uniquely situated to deal with these sorts of matters, because really it's about the rehabilitation and ensuring the services are provided so that a juvenile can be successful and complete those terms of the continuance for dismissal and be able to address the issues that brought them into court in the first place.
Can you speak, counsel, to the last argument, which juvenile, which has to do with the sufficiency of the evidence? And I think the initial question of the interpretation of the statute, that either by its plain language or applying an ambiguity standard, the policy purpose subdivision one has to be incorporated as part of the elements of the crime. And that, you know, I think on various things that there must be damage caused and used and victimized, you know, those keywords that come out of the policy purpose. Is there case law that tells us one way or the other how to address a subdivision dealing with policy and purpose in a statute that later lays out the specific elements of the crime?
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't have that specific case law at my fingertips, but I would just note that that policy language does tie in even with this charge, in that it's the policy to try to avoid this sort of child pornography work being created and being put out into the community, and that's a valid concern. The statute has been in effect since 1982. There have been very minor changes to the statute, even as we do enter more of an era of Snapchat, TikTok, and Facebook, where you can so easily share things. I think it ties in with there also being a need for better education.
Judge Smith, is okay if I ask one quick question? I know we're out of time. So help us understand how, and it's the same question I asked Mr. Lau, in the definition of pornographic work, how are we to interpret the word uses a minor? Because that, you know, you could argue that, you know, that there's some, it means something more than just that a minor is in a photograph or not. So how should we interpret that word
in the
definition?
I would note that a similar argument was raised to the trial court, and the trial court had addressed it, finding that the pornographic work definition that I have is an original or reproduction of a picture, film, photograph, video of a sexual performance involving a minor. And so that involving a minor is close to the use of a minor. But I would posit that
this doesn't satisfy the definition of a sexual performance, which is separately defined. It means any play, dance, or other exhibition. So then we're down into F2, correct? So it's any visual depiction, et cetera, that uses a minor. And so I'm just trying to figure out what's the, and if you don't have any particular thoughts or wisdom other than that a minor appears, I mean, that's fine. We're out of time.
Sure. I would just note that these images and videos used a minor. And then I would just respectfully request that you affirm the district court's finding of guilt and adjudication of delinquency. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, Mr. Lau, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I'd like to do two things quickly, and then if I have time, quibble with some of the discussions about the factual record. So the first thing I'd like to do is provide an example of why, sort of illustrating why age should not matter in this case, right? So say we have three individuals in a bar, two of them are friends, the two get into an argument with that third person. Now one person's 20, one of the friends is 22, the other is 20, right? And they get into a bar fight. And so one, say the defendant gets into a fight and punches the guy, kicks him on the ground. The other does the exact same thing. And so they end up charging, knowing the complete facts in that case. The prosecutor chooses to charge defendant, but not the friend. And so, you know, if there was a selective prosecution argument raised in a case like that, and the state simply said, well, you know, your defendant was 22 and the other was 20, and that's enough to show that this was not either arbitrary or invidious, no one would accept that. But I don't see how that case is different from this case.
I wonder whether someone, counsel, might accept that, because when I read BAH, it quotes State v. Anderson, another Supreme Court case, Minnesota Supreme Court, and explains that myriad factors can enter into the prosecutor's decision. Two persons might commit the same crime, and yet the prosecutor is not compelled by law, duty, or tradition to treat them the same. On the contrary, he is expected to exercise discretion and common sense to the end that if, for example, one is a young first offender and the other older, and then gives other examples.
Right.
The prosecutor can and should take such factors into account. I mean, so it seems like a blessing of taking age into account between two similarly situated offenders.
Well, I would say that, you know, taking this scenario in a complete vacuum, where these two individuals are entirely similarly situated, where they have the same criminal history.
Given at this point. It's a given they're similarly situated. We're now into whether age is a rational difference maker.
Right. I'm just talking about my hypothetical. In BAH, they're talking about other factors to consider, right? In addition to, you know, say in this example, age. Here, all we're talking about is age. All district court relied on was the distinction in age between the two individuals. And again, both are minors. And if the state were able to prove, which they didn't, and they still haven't, prove that one was more mature than the other because of that relative age, then I would agree that that age is a relevant consideration. But the state didn't do that here. And the district court didn't find that they proved that here. Now, with regards to the analytical framework for a selective prosecution case, and the and the standard of review, I would argue, and I know that, you know, at this point we've gone back and forth on this, that this is more like a Ramey test, right? Ultimately, it is the defendant's burden to establish that there is some invidious intent by pointing to the record, and that is the burden of the person making the claim, and then it's on the state to rebut that. The state has its own burden. And I think the state needs to provide a legitimate reason. The case law is crystal clear on that. BAH is crystal clear on that. And so the state here did provide that reason. And our argument is that that reason is insufficient.
May I ask you one thing, Mr. Lau? I know you're trying to do a lot within your short time frame.
I know. No, it's fine.
The one thing the district court talks about in its order on this issue is apparently appellant asked for production of prosecution records so that they could look at past prosecution, and those were produced, and the district court looked at that too. 18 that were charged, 11 adult, 5 juvenile delinquency, and did not find any pattern of discrimination. And the court does talk about that in addition to age as part of its basis for its decision. How do we use that?
We don't re-raise that claim, right? We do not try to demonstrate selective prosecution by showing that there's some sort of pattern. What we're relying on, and what in part the defense attorney down below relies on, is this analytical framework that's provided in BAH. One person who is very similarly situated to another person was charged and the other was not.
But does that additional evidence in this record strengthen or give, you know, further credence to the district court's conclusion?
I would argue no, because again, these are two different arguments that are being made. One is that there's a pattern. The other is that in this distinct case, both should have been charged or neither. So for the reasons I provided here today, I would ask the court to reverse appellant's delinquency adjudication. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. The case is submitted.